into it. All right. The rest of you, if you'd be so kind, if you could please stand with me as God's people stood at the foot of a stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we stand, just to recognize that this is one of the primary places that God encounters us through his word. We're going to start in verse 1 of Proverbs chapter 8, read all the way until we get to verse 11 together. Begins this way: does not wisdom call out? Does not understanding raise her voice? The highest points along the way where the paths meet, she, wisdom, Lady Wisdom, takes her stand. Beside the gate leading into the city, at the entrance, she cries aloud, "To you, O people, I call out. I raise my voice to all of humankind. You who are single-minded, you who are simple," that's what that means, "gain prudence. You who are foolish, set your hearts on wisdom, on it. Listen, for I have trustworthy things to say. I open my lips to speak what is true, what is right. My mouth speaks what is true, for my lips detest wickedness. All the words of my mouth are just. None of them is crooked or perverse. To the discerning, all of them are right. They are upright to those who have found knowledge. Choose my instruction instead of silver, knowledge rather than choice gold, for wisdom is more precious than rubies, and nothing you desire can compare with her." These are the inspired words of God. You may be seated. Whether it is someone, I don't know, guiding us in our lives, giving us advice in terms of, you know, what to eat, what not to eat, what percentage of that should be plant-based versus animal protein, or what percentage of that should be filled with carbohydrates or no carbohydrates, or whether it's somebody guiding, a friend or a family member guiding us into the right life partner, or whether or not we even need the right life partner at all, whether it's somebody guiding us, helping us get our financial house in order, or whether it's somebody trying to give us some advice on how to move our body, which types of exercises are better than another, or how you might better influence people or win friends, or you know, what are the rudimentary basics of how to set boundaries for yourself, or what does it mean to pay attention to that self in connection to others. My point is, life advice is not in short supply when it comes to our culture today. It is pretty much everywhere these days, and perhaps this could be traced back to one Mr. Socrates, who called us to know thyself, to know ourselves well. In fact, John Calvin, in the beginning of his Institute, says you can know God, and either you can study God, or you can even learn about God by knowing yourself, studying the human being, because we are created in the image of God. Or when the Stoics said, you know, my externals are not in my power, and my will is within, you know, my power, in the things of my own, or to put that in today's language, you can't control what's happening around you. All you can control is how you respond, or as the late, great Greg Hardin once put it, mentor of folks like Tom Brady, mentors of folks like Charles Woodson, Desmond Howard, Michael Phelps, he said, all you can do is control the controllables. That was his mantra throughout most of his counseling sessions. All you can control is the controllables. The entire self-help industry, and then some when you take into account, you know, social media outlets and things like that, is astounding. In fact, self-improvement is a 13 plus billion dollar industry. Some of the biggest voices, some of the most well-known voices, have net worths of $500 to $600 million dollars. And that area, by the way, shows no sign of slowing down. Just since 2014, so like a decade, in the publishing world, tripled this entire area. And it's borderline almost quadrupled in just 10 years in terms of production of things within this realm. You could even say that we are self-improving ourselves to death, to put it in a different sort of way. So what is this multi-billion dollar industry selling at its core? Wisdom. Selling wisdom at its core. Now, to be sure, it's of a certain variety. It certainly comes from a certain worldview and a certain perspective. Not all of it's bad by any means. It definitely gives us a certain lens. Some of it's focused primarily on the individual, and that depends what you're reading, but it often comes through that lens, an individualistic lens. Sometimes it's just short, quick, you know, cognitive behavior therapy type fixes in our lives. But it's very similar to the kind of wisdom, like if you remember in 1 Corinthians, Paul said, Greeks look for wisdom, the Jews are looking for signs, the Jews, of course, are waiting for the Messiah, but Greeks are in pursuit. It's very similar to that pursuit, though again, it's from a different lens and a different variety, but it's still there. We are today in pursuit of wisdom, and there are five writings in the Old Testament which have been historically characterized as wisdom. These include the book of Job and the book of Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Song. These are the typical wisdom books of the Old Testament. And some of the writing sounds a lot like self-help. A perfect example of that would be the book of Proverbs. And some of the writings is like the complete opposite. It's like literally the antithesis of self-help, and that would be like the books of Ecclesiastes or even the book of Job as an example. But among the traditions, among wisdom traditions, and these could be ancient, these can be, say, modern ones, the Bible's wisdom has a unique perspective on what it means to, one, see the world, but what it means to live in this world well in a way that echoes down through the rest of the Bible. And one of the things that, say, the wisdom books in the Old Testament bring together that you don't often find in other self-help books is knowledge, spiritual knowledge, knowledge of God and intellect. Or you could say knowledge of God and common sense, or knowledge of God and science, or knowledge of God or, you know, evidence-based science. Like, those things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but biblical wisdom has within it a knowledge of God and some of these other things that you don't necessarily find in, say, self-help books. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, because the Bible's wisdom also crosses over all sorts of boundaries. It uses different languages. It often has different genres compared to one another. But it also will bring different perspectives together that don't necessarily seem like they fit together. Juxtapositions, puzzling sort of contrasts that I think can actually deepen our faith and deepen our understanding of the world and deepen our understanding even of reality. And so one of the main aspects, if you learn one thing from me today, is this. One of the main aspects of biblical wisdom is that it brings various perspectives together that don't necessarily seem like they fit. And so the wisdom books on their own, like I heard I have a little more time here, like that's what I heard, that I'm gonna be here for a little bit longer. So like if we were to just study one of the books in like Proverbs or the book of Psalms, which would take a while, that in itself is fascinating. So the individual wisdom books on their own are fascinating. But when you take them together, when you take all five of them together, see them sort of from that perspective, their perspective on how we might see the world is illuminating. It is truly illuminating. Take Proverbs and Ecclesiastes just as an example of this. And just start, I like simple questions. Maybe I'm a simple person, but I like simple questions. One of the simple questions I have is why does Proverbs and Ecclesiastes belong in the Bible? Like, why are both of them in the same book? Why are they both considered the inspired word of God? Because Proverbs gives this sense that if you make the right decisions in your life, things will go well for you. Like, if you make better decisions in your life, I mean, here's an example of something like that. If the righteous receive their due on earth, how much more would the ungodly and the sinner receive their reward, right? Their consequences. And it seems that simple. And sometimes it seems that, like, there's sometimes where I do want to tell people, like, in my own life, like, if you just stop doing that, your life will be better, right? It's just, like, that simple. Stop doing stupid stuff, and then things will go better in your life. And that's sort of like sometimes you read the Proverbs, it's like, oh yeah, stop doing dumb stuff, things seem to go okay, right? And then Ecclesiastes comes along and says, hold the phone, not so fast. In some cases, it doesn't even matter if you do the right thing. It doesn't even matter if you make wise decisions. It doesn't even matter if you make foolish decisions. In some cases, in fact, Ecclesiastes is just one example of many, Ecclesiastes 7:15, in this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these, the righteous perishing of the righteousness, in their righteousness, in their wise decisions, and the wicked living a long life in their wickedness. There's another example of, like, you could be as prudent as you want, get your family house finances in order so that somebody else, when you get diagnosed with cancer, can enjoy all of that nice prudence of yours. Right? It's basically, like, sometimes it really doesn't matter if you make the right decision. Sometimes it doesn't even matter if you make the wrong decision, because there's something called old age that will either get you, or some sort of, you know, disease that will get you, or some sort of cancer that will get you. And often life feels this way, that it's a one chasing after the wind in which you will never catch. And sometimes life seems that simple. Life's messy, it's complicated, it doesn't always make sense in this way. And confronted with both of these perspectives that we find in the same Bible, it only makes sense to ask another simple question, and that is, which one is the more accurate picture of reality? Which one's more accurate about how life works? Proverbs or Ecclesiastes? How does the Bible answer that? Yeah. Yeah. Yep. One of the unique features that you won't find in Mesopotamian, and I won't get too deep into that today, but one of the unique features in Mesopotamian wisdom, one of the unique features in the Bible compared to ancient other wisdoms, is that the Bible includes books like Ecclesiastes, which deconstruct the more positive, strongest sort of aspects or affirmations of, say, the Proverbs. It goes after some of those. And it's not that Proverbs or Ecclesiastes are sort of first drafts, and we're just kind of waiting for a final draft where these things get more mushed together, because something would be lost if we did that. In fact, something very important would be lost. We need both of these views of life, because each actually ring true. Each of these ring true in our actual lives at least some of the time. And if you just combine both Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, we tend to lose this. And so biblical wisdom, if you want to put it this way, biblical wisdom is the holding intention, say, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, or at least that view of the world intention. Philosophically speaking, Proverbs is sort of your Plato and Hegel sitting down, and their view of the world. If you know anything about Plato, this is just a copycat world of an ideal world. And so you're basically, this is a nice, tidy world. Everything sort of works as a system, and there's nothing sort of obscure. It just works. What you put in is what you sort of get out. And Ecclesiastes, by contrast to this, is your sort of Kierkegaardian, Russian, tragic thinker view of the world. The world is obscure. It's impenetrable. It's an impenetrable place. And if you've ever been to a conference which peddles more positive, optimistic sort of views of the world, they would respond, Ecclesiastes' view of the world would respond, that is a laughable, like, oversimplistic view of reality, and it doesn't even begin to plumb the depths of sort of our human experience, which includes pain, which includes suffering, which includes the righteous even suffering, despite them making all sort of, quote-unquote, the right decisions. And this is where Christians, we need to know our personalities. We need to know our dispositions individually, but also collectively. We need to know sort of how we are bent. We need to know our temperaments well, because if we are a people who love neatness, and I don't just mean hygiene and clean house, I mean you like when the world works the right way, if you follow the rules, this is the outcome, right? Annie's a rule follower. I'm very much not a rule follower, but like she's that way, right? If this is how things work, if you do this, this is what's supposed to happen. If you're more like the world in that manner, let us not rewrite this Bible in our own image, and vice versa. Maybe you are one who is thrilled with the messiness of life, and maybe that's too strong. Maybe you're not thrilled with the messiness of life, but you've experienced some of the messiness of life, as well as the obscurity and sort of the irreconcilable human sort of things that happen in our life, and the unpredictability and the pain that comes with life. Let us assume that the Bible wasn't just written for us. It wasn't just written for those who appreciate that. In fact, let us give thanks when the Bible doesn't think as we do. In fact, here's one of the tests. If the Bible always agrees with you, and I mean about everything, your perspective on humanity or your perspective on what society should do more of, or maybe it always agrees with what you're doing already in your life, that's a sign you and me are reading the Bible as a mirror when the Bible is in fact a window through which we can better understand the world, a window through which we can better understand who God is ultimately in Christ as well, the necessary tension between Proverbs and Ecclesiastes was once highlighted by the 19th century pastor by the name of Charles Simeon, and he said, you know, the truth isn't found in the middle. Often we, as reformers, get accused of standing in the middle, meaning we're not going to go to this extreme, we're not going to go to that extreme, or, you know, those fanatics, I don't know about that. We're just going to kind of find the sweet spot in the middle. And Charles Simeon said, no, the truth isn't found in the middle, and nor is it found in one extreme over and against another extreme. The truth is found in both extremes. And this is, you know, this is important. Chesterton once put it this way: the real trouble with our world is not that it's not reasonable. It's not that we don't live in a Proverbs world, and it's not that it's completely unreasonable. It's not all anarchy. We don't live in Ecclesiastes world. He said it's nearly reasonable. It's almost reasonable, the world that we live in. It's just not quite. In other words, our perspective of the world, all of us, our perspective of the world, our perspectives on humanity, our perspectives on politics, our perspectives on society, they almost always work, but they don't fully. They never quite close the deal. This is why you can play devil's advocate the rest of your life, because people's perspectives don't quite sum up how life completely and utterly works. They never quite do. Thus, the very tension between Proverbs and Ecclesiastes in the Bible, I think, perfectly captures these irreconcilable aspects of our human experience. The Bible refuses to make Proverbs the only lens through which you see the world and I see the world, and the Bible refuses to make Ecclesiastes the entire view of which you and I see the world. In fact, we need both of these views to have a full, more robust, more complex, more deep, more mature faith, as well as lens through which we see the world. This can help us even make sense of what we just did together in singing worship. You know, if you've ever belted out the song, God, I will, how does that, I'm trying to remember, every blessing. So if you've ever belted out the words together, every blessing that you pour out, I'll turn back to praise. Or maybe you were at a youth camp and sang a song equivalent to, you know, God, wherever you call me, wherever you lead me, I'll go. I'll follow you. How many of you have ever sung either of those songs or that variety of songs? Right. Now, if you make Proverbs the only way in which you see your relationship with God or the only way in which you enter into the world, thinking that we will follow Jesus every single hour of our lives, every moment, and only think about him, not only does that set us up for failure, if you start teaching that stuff to other people, you're also going to set them up for failure, and you're going to look like the biggest hypocrite on the face of the planet. And vice versa. This doesn't mean, you know, we shouldn't also make Ecclesiastes the sort of whole view of things as we worship God or pursue a relationship. It's not that we should start shunning, you know, sort of the more positive, optimistic sort of worship songs that we sing, because we know we will never live up to those words. I'm not suggesting here that, you know, instead of, you know, saying, God, wherever you lead, wherever you call, I will follow you. I don't think we should replace those words with something like, God, if you follow, or if you call me, all things being equal, I probably won't. Frankly, I most likely won't follow you all the time, but I sure hope I will. I don't think we should start singing that song or those lyrics. For one, that doesn't rhyme very well. So I'm not suggesting this, but if we sing and worship, if we pursue God, if we follow God with biblical wisdom in mind, it avoids both of those extremes, making more sense of the optimistic lyrics, making more sense of the simple positive, because here's the thing, Proverbs is true. The pursuit of righteousness is true. Like, that's not, but here's the thing, it's not the full truth. For one, we are all in need of the same gospel. It's not the full truth. And perhaps more of our songs should even reflect the Ecclesiastes lens of things. And I've seen some movement on that front, if you have noticed, in recent worship music. There includes some of these irreconcilable aspects of our human experience. But here is where I think the book of Job can be incredibly helpful. And this is parental warning. This is for those of age. There's really only one way you can read Job. As my professor once said, you pour yourself one single glass of wine. One, Okay, I'm not a wine drinker, but if you are, one single glass of wine, you sit down, you put cello music on, you set the mood with the lighting, and you read it from beginning to end, the whole thing. It's the only way to experience Job at its sort of, you know, at its real sort of message level. So, again, parental warning there. But if you're in the book of Job in the right way, as my professor once put it, Job does something truly profound with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. For one, if you're in the beginning chapter, you're in the prologue, there's this discussion that takes place, which, again, would mean more reflections on this. I don't have time for it today, but like, there's this moment where Satan's having a conversation with God, and he begs the question, does Job fear God for nothing? And in his opinion, no. I mean, you've given him all this stuff. He's a wealthy man. Of course he likes you. Everything's going well with him. And so when you're in chapter one, you're in sort of the Proverbs world. You're like, oh, okay. So as the book goes, there's a reason for why he's suffering. Like, this conversation took place. And so you're in this world. Everything sort of makes sense. Job's this faithful guy. Yet he's suffering, but there's a reason behind it. Right? And then you get later on in the book, so we are in chapters 38 and 42, and then God asks subsequently 66 questions, really quick, in succession. And he gives no justification and no reason for why Job is suffering, despite his faithfulness. And now you're back in Ecclesiastes land, like nothing makes sense. Like, why is this man, of all faithful people, why does Job have to be going through this? And of course, his friends are giving him reasons for why they think he is. And right when you start thinking, like, we're in anarchy, we're in a nihilistic world, everything is meaningless, and all of that, then you read at the end of that book in Job 42, after Job had prayed, he's a faithful man, for his friends, what happens? God restored his fortunes and gave him twice as much as he had before. Boom. I knew we were in a Proverbs world. It's sort of the lessons people have taught me since I was a young kid. If you just do the right thing, if you just remain faithful, it's all going to work out in the end. Like, all you do is remain faithful. Do the right thing over and over and over again. Everything in your life is going to work out. Proverbs land. Job is in Proverbs land. Until you are, again, at the end of that glass of wine. If you've done two glasses, you're already in bed. You haven't even got to this point, right? But if you've only had one glass and you're in that last chapter, you start pondering it a little more and you go, wait a minute. He lost 10 kids. Gone. They weren't returned back to him. You don't get over that. You don't just all of a sudden recover from something like that. And he's had more children. But that goes with you the rest of your life. And then you start piling up all the suffering and all the ways in which God allowed Satan to do these things, though he wasn't ever supposed to physically touch him, put a finger on him. You start piling up all the trauma and all that. You don't think he's carrying that emotionally, physically. And then all of a sudden you're back in Ecclesiastes land with more questions than you are, and I am, with answers. The book of Job, the end of it, leave somebody who sees the world only through a Proverbs-like lens scratching their head. And the book of Job leaves the person who sees the world only through an Ecclesiastes-like lens, everything is meaningless, scratching their head. And the real genius of the book of Job is it holds those two things in tension, these radically different perspectives on the world. This radical tension, never blunting either of them, because Proverbs and Ecclesiastes is in fact how each and every one of us experience the human experience. Here's the thing, neither of them though are the full truth. Neither of them. And see, so often we as Christians individually, but we as, say, Christians as the church, we tend to make one of these lenses the primary lens through which we see things. Without throwing too much shade on too many Christian communities, I won't do that. I think there's too much of that already. One of the things we often do as Christians, we'll just take on one of these lenses. So for example, there are churches and Christians who only take on the Proverbs-like lens through the world, right? And this is what they peddle to people, essentially. Like, if you become a Christian, if you join us or you join our community or you send your kids here, everything is going to go better for you. things will get better, not worse. If you start making the right decisions, everything is sort of like, the only way I can describe this, how many of you, I think the bit belongs to originally Jeff Foxworthy, who said, you know, in a country song played forward, you know, you lose things, right? You lose your spouse, you lose your dog, you lose your truck, and then, you know, you lose your job and you become an alcoholic, right? So like, that's the country song forward. But if you reverse the country song, you get your dog back and you get your spouse back and you get your truck back and you get your, you know, you get my drift. Often this is how Christians will peddle Christianity in the world. If you become a Christian, you get to play the country song backwards. And you get all these things back and your life goes well. Is there some truth in that? Yeah. Because there are certain laws in which Christians are following that buck up against human reality, right? So if you buck up against those actual rules and how life works, you're going to end up, it's not going to go well. But is it the full truth? No. And I can give you countless examples of two Christians whose marriages didn't work. They just didn't work. And then vice versa. There are churches who only see things through the Ecclesiastes lens. And these are the types of churches where we don't have any questions. We don't have any answers. Life is tragic. Forgetting that Ecclesiastes, it says everything is meaningless, but everything is meaningless apart from God. And so there are churches who only take on Ecclesiastes. There's Christian communities who take on just that sort of standard lens. But each of these are oversimplistic views of the human experience and views of the world when we treat them in isolation. And then when we treat them apart from God and we treat them in isolation from the gospel itself. But when we hold these things together, as the Bible and the biblical wisdom does, and as the book of Job does so brilliantly, they can provide us a richer, a more complex, a deeper, a more fully orbed way in which we not only see the world, but ultimately the way we even experience reality itself with God. Would you please pray with me? God of all wisdom, thank you. Thank you for your word. Jesus Christ, illumine our minds and our bodies by that word so that we might see every part of your creation as a reflection of your glory, as a reflection of your power, as a reflection of your wisdom. God, help us not to miss how contingent we are. Help us not to miss how dependent we truly, each and every one of us, are. That we're not here, not ever at just the beginning. Because before us were our mothers, before us were our fathers, before us were our teachers, before us were our pastors, before us were many scholars who worked hard and saw much. Before us were those fanatics who at great risk kept your text, your word, for us. And before all of them, again, is you, the source. You in your wisdom, you in your glory, you in your power, you in your mercy, you in your forgiveness, your love. God, we gain our wisdom not as isolated travelers through time, but in the presence of each of these witnesses. We gain our wisdom from you, we gain it toward you and in you, so that our work, so that our lives might be as an act of worship, an act of praise for you. You who give us all of our years, you who give us all of our wisdom, you who give us all of our insight, and you who rule and guide all of our lives. We pray this in the name of the Father, the name of the Son, in the name of the Holy Spirit, and all of God's people say,